Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, we are transmitting to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century. Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost. Whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you. This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 386.DA1125, certificate number 40773, Thomas Alexandre Dumas.
What is it?
The Count of Monte Cristo.
Well, Charmin!
Richard, thank you for joining us on the Omnibus Project. Where are you broadcasting? Well, whither are you broadcasting?
Hey, thanks, Shaw. Thanks for having me. I am in Tallahassee, Florida.
Tallahassee?
Yeah.
One of the lesser known Floridas.
Yeah. It's not the tourist center part or anything like that. It's lower Georgia, effectively, in some
sense. Yeah, do you think of yourself as lower Georgia? I see maps all the time where people are trying to redraw the Constitution of the United States. By Constitution, I mean, you know, how the states are made up, and it always ends up that Tallahassee is the capital of South Georgia.
Yeah, it's pretty rural up here compared to Central Florida, and of course, you know, the Southeast and stuff like that.
And are you affiliated with the military at all? I know that's a big presence there.
No, in Tallahassee, not too much military here. Pensacola out west. Oh, is a big,
that's
big,
what I
big
meant.
Base.
Pensacola, yeah. Right.
Yeah, it's all right. I went to school at Pensacola, so I figured that's what you were talking about.
So what do you do there in Tallahassee?
I work for the FDA. I'm a milk and dairy specialist with the dairy division.
And is that like a big, I think of dairy as being sort of a Minnesota, like a northern plains state thing.
Yeah, we're all over. Most of our division is remote employees. We're kind of all over the country. We do have a lot of dairy in Florida compared to the rest of the Southeast. But yeah, of course, the Midwest is kind of where a lot of it's concentrated. And Pennsylvania and New York have a lot, California, Texas. But part of the job is traveling around, going to those states. I'm actually in the lab type program, so evaluating the laboratories that have to test milk to ensure its safety and quality.
Do cows like to be warm?
Do cows like to be warm?
I mean, do cows like warm, humid country, or do they like a cold morning?
I don't know. Yeah, I deal with the lab side of it. I never see the cows. I just see the final product and the raw milk itself. But that's it.
Right. So you've never interviewed a cow?
Yeah, I'm never out there with the cows in my current position.
So you know, you join a long and venerable history of Omnibus listeners and futurelings who are in the sciences and the and professional careers. So I would assume that you would be here to do some sort of Omnibus episode that was based in biology or some kind of history of agriculture, because of course we've done quite a few of those.
Sure. Yep.
But that's not why you're here today. You're coming at this episode from what would be maybe an unexpected direction.
Yeah, definitely not really science related. When I was in school, biology was definitely my focus, but I minored in history, always liked history and military history and whatnot. And so I kind of gravitate more toward those episodes more than the hard science episodes, to be honest. You know, that's my day-to-day job. I like to get away from that when I can't.
And so what was your major? I mean, that's the craziest cocktail party question to ask somebody. Like, I feel like maybe we're in a bar in Pensacola.
Yeah.
What was your, like, how did you find your path to lab work?
Yeah, kind of funny. My major was actually in marine biology. I lived in Florida my whole life and went to school on the coastal there in Pensacola. And, really liked marine biology, did that kind of stuff. But, you know, unless you're going to stay in academia, you know, the marine biology, or there's a handful of things out there, environmental. I started out doing environmental work with our state's version of the EPA. It's called the Department of Environmental Protection. Did that for a few years. That kind of got me into another position with our state Department of Agriculture doing food safety testing. And I really just kind of gravitated toward that and spent 17 years with that agency doing food testing, and then also doing sample collection and recall work and outbreak work and whatnot, kind of based on those sample results, and found my way to the milk side here at FDA. So my corny joke is I moved from sea cows to moo cows.
Sea cows to moo cows. Yeah. I feel like finding your way to milk is that's like a milk product advertising slogan that we haven't heard yet.
But Yeah.
So without getting too political, as you know, Omnibus always stays as far away from politics as we can. But is the work of the Florida EPA and a lot of this food safety stuff in Florida specifically, is it changing now with Florida kind of leading the charge in some of the, I don't know what you would call it, maybe anti-science?
The department, as far as I know of, it's been 3 years since I worked for the state level, but they're still very committed to food safety. I still have a lot of friends that work in the area. Florida also became like a lot of states, hemp has a varying kind of quasi-legal status depending on whether it's medical or whether it's recreational or whatnot. And Florida is no different. It's kind of always up in the air. So a lot of our food safety testing is also taking on hemp testing to make sure that the products are safe biologically from pathogens, but also that the products that are sold just for non THC don't contain those THC alkaloids that would push it into the drug realm. So
I did not think we were going to get into hemp testing so fast,
and neither did we. Honestly, it came really fast when I was still at the agency, and they still do a lot of testing.
You know, in my own life, we did a lot of hemp testing, but it was very it was not a very rigorous. testing, sort of architecture. There was one point in the late 80s where there was a real hemp drought. We're going to call it hemp for the purposes of this conversation.
Sure, yeah.
Hemp drought in the United States. There'd been some interdiction and a whole, the usual shipments from south of the border were all missing. But there was a bunch of weed that had clearly come across the border in a gas tank of some kind of, either in a semi truck or, they'd loaded these bales into a gas tank. And so all of the weed just reeked of gasoline. And I was traveling across the country at the time, and everywhere you went, people were confronted with this gas weed problem, which was there's no other weed, and we all want to have weed, but this weed is clearly very, very bad. Not just bad for you, but also very bad to smoke. And in the course of this trip across the country, I saw like several different groups of stoners in different American states grappling with whether or not the gas weed would be safe. And gradually, you know, the more adventurous members of each one of these underground communities was like, you know what? I'm smoking the gas weed. From your perspective, how bad was the gas weed for
America? A chemistry problem. I was on the biology side. So we were testing for Listeria, Salmonella, E. coli, that kind of stuff. So
I
let the chemists handle that stuff. That's their problem, not mine.
Right. Good point. Yeah, of course. I'm gonna guess that it was bad, although probably. Can you get Listeria by smoking a thing?
Well, it was more because it was being put in edibles. Edibles became really big around the same time. So it was effectively products we would be testing. Maybe not that exact product, food product, yeah. So similar things, but different what we'd call a matrices to test in. So like we would normally test ready-to-eat products that would be like sandwiches, salads, that kind of stuff. And now we're testing like all these different gummy-type products that we didn't have a method for to test because nobody had ever tested gummies for that kind of stuff. But here we are, you know.
Well, we think of horses' hooves as being extremely, you know, not just palatable, but extremely clean and full of vitamins, so.
Just throw the horse in there. It's fine. You'll be fine.
Well, so does our show today have any connection to the Gulf Coast or Florida? I mean, why don't you walk us into it?
Yeah, the closest would be the Caribbean. Florida kind of sticks down to the Caribbean. The protagonist of today's story was born in the French colony of Santo Domingue, which would be modern day Haiti. So in the island of Hispaniola. So that's not exactly close to Florida, but it's, you know, closer than some of the other parts of the country, of course.
Sure. Part of a Creole culture.
Exactly. Yeah.
And what, tell me briefly about, Santo Domingue. Did you say Santo Domingo or Ga?
Yeah, it was just called Saint Domingue was the name of the colony at the time. Yeah, that was the French name for the colony in the western half of the island. The other eastern half would have been Spanish.
Right, and that's the difference between Haiti and the Dominican Republic
Correct.
Today.
Yeah, present day Haiti and Dominican Republic. Yep.
And so, Haiti was maybe what the first revolution against a European power in the Caribbean, is that right, or is that how it gained its freedom?
Yeah, I forget the details, but yeah, it's basically the one of the first like slave revolts that were successful. Yeah. And that was kind of toward the end of the time period here that the story today takes place in. Yeah.
So jump us off. Where are we?
Well, I guess how I kind of discovered it is, you know, graduating college. Now you're in the workforce, and you know you're expected to be a little more, maybe cultured and professional in your life. And realize I had some kind of glaring gaps in my literature knowledge, so to speak. So sort of wanted to just kind of read some of these classics that you know you've heard about, maybe seen the movie of, but haven't actually read the book for.
I'm impressed, actually. I mean, I think there are a lot of people that do not recognize those gaps in their education and feel like filling them would be like a waste of time. So kudos to you.
Yeah. So being, again, science related and one of the things that originally got me into marine biology, if you remember the old Disney version of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, you know, the old classic, you know.
Right. Yeah. Classic of French literature.
Yeah. So I picked that up and started and read that first and then read Dracula. You know, we're recording this close to Halloween here. So that was a big one, too. And then got to the Count of Monte Cristo and really liked it. Since read it a couple of times, it's kind of become my favorite kind of fiction, you know, piece of literature. And I think probably like a lot of folks, you know, fiction literature is not exactly my go-to reading material. It tends to be some kind of history book or whatever. My wife makes fun of me because she'll be reading a book and I'm like, well, how many pages is it? And, you know, she'll be like, oh, it's 400 pages. I'm like, no, but really, how many pages is it? Because every history book has about 100 pages of notes and citations and stuff like that for somebody that's read it. And so, you know, she's reading something and it's, you know, fiction tends to go, it's the last page. What are the last pages? That's how many pages it is. Whereas what I'm reading, that's, well, you know, only 3/4 of the book is that. The other half is, you know, the quarter is reference or whatever. So, yeah, so that kind of became a go-to for me. You know, I read it, you know, once a decade or so since then, kind of go through it and trying to get my kids into it as well.
Did you feel the same way about The Three Musketeers? Were you a Dumas completist?
Yeah, not really, honestly. Like, I read those actually before. I think, you know, we had to read some of them in high school, or at least some excerpts of it. And, you know, it was good, but not great. In my opinion, people would argue that's definitely the most famous. You know, I don't want the Dumas files coming after me here. But, yeah, I kind of gravitated more toward the Count of Monte Cristo. I don't know if it's just the, you know, maybe I'm just a little more revengeful or something. I don't know.
So summarize the plot of the Count of Monte Cristo for those of our science-based readers who haven't made their way to it.
Yeah, sure. So I guess the elevator pitch for it would be, you know, the protagonist there, Edmond Dantès, he's kind of on his way to becoming hired, not necessarily a captain, but higher up in shipping and whatnot, in southern France there, in kind of Catalan region, kind of between that border of Spain and France. And he comes back into town. His success is kind of being resented by some of his peers. He's got the beautiful wife or beautiful girlfriend soon to be marrying him, hopefully waiting on him. He's got a couple of friends and kind of frenemies that are hanging out with him, you know, kind of deal. But they all kind of resent him. They hatch a plot to frame him. He ends up imprisoned in the Chateau d'If, just the prison offshore there. He meets a wise figure, the Abbé Ferrara, who kind of teaches him everything from classics and fencing and everything, history and whatnot, sciences, natural sciences at the time, I guess they'd call it. And then on his deathbed, teaches him or tells him where this fabulous treasure is hidden on the Isle of Monte Cristo. Edmund escapes kind of, I don't want to give the plot away, but in a pretty dramatic manner, makes his way to the Isle, recovers the treasure, and then, you know, spends the rest of the book basically plotting his revenge against these people that have wronged him. You know, it's been several years while he's been imprisoned, and, the woman he loved had married one of his enemies and had kids. So he kind of works his way in through that in one way and through business in the other. And in the end, basically their greed ends up, betraying them all, and most of them end up, you know, end up meeting their end at his devices, you know, while he's become fabulously wealthy.
I feel like revenge fantasies, although we're shy to admit to them, are fairly common among people that aren't sociopaths, right? Sure, it's not necessarily a trait of someone who's a danger to his community.
Right. And maybe that's why the books are so popular. You know, it's something that everyone kind of, you think about, but you would never act on. So you get to read about the people that are acting on it. And it's a release of some kind, maybe.
Yeah. It's not like it's a book about waiting in the bushes to stab your neighbor.
It's a complex. Yeah.
Yeah. They get their comeuppance is what
exactly.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were the bad ones.
Yeah. And I think Dumas at the time was writing, getting paid by the line. So it behooved him to make the story as convoluted and complex as possible.
And so did this then create in you a kind of an interest in France and French culture? I mean, you know, the French really dominated a literature in the 19th century. I know I read a thing not very long ago that the French have more Nobel Prizes in literature than any other nation. But that would have been only in the 20th century. But yeah, all these classics of French literature during that period. How did it change your feelings about France and Frenchness?
Yeah, I definitely, you know, was more intrigued on it. You know, it's one of those, well, I'm going to read a little more, kind of study up more from a history standpoint. Yeah, I'm sorry to say it didn't really launch my French literary career anything like that.
Don't apologize to me.
As far as I got.
I majored in Russian lit, so I'm...
No. So, just, you know, being a fan of history, I would read a little bit more on history and whatnot. Just, you know, anything came up on that, but that was really it. Like it I'm not going to say it dead ended. It just was another piece in the pocketbook there. You know, so it's another piece of paper in the folder. Well, I've got that under my belt now, and that's interesting. And you know, when something would come up that would tie to it, like okay, that's around the same time period or something like that or whatnot. And
yeah, so we're talking Count of Monte Cristo. We're talking about what, 1870?
He was born 1762, so you're probably talking about Dumas writing this, you know, late or early 1800s kind of thing is when a lot of this would have been probably taking place.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, yeah, that's quite a bit earlier than I would have thought. But then I'm, again, not a French literature.
Okay. Aside from the one, neither am I. So,
so what time period does the story take place? It's obviously not, it doesn't take place in the time that it was written. It's casting back to an earlier time.
Yeah. For Count of Monte Cristo. Yeah. It's, I'm not sure what the time frame of the, you know, it's around that same kind of period, you know, post-revolutionary France kind of thing. You know, Napoleon makes a brief kind of appearance, I guess is the word you'd say in the book. He's already on Elba at the time. So that would have been, you know, that's
okay.
Again, not to give away some of the plot of the book, but
right. But that gives us a sense of the time.
Yeah, that gives us a time frame there.
So does it explain, or let me ask you this. Do you know then much about the Napoleonic Wars, just in the broadest sketch of them?
Yeah, just again, broad sketch, reading for the stuff for this topic, as I became more interested, it's, you can't separate the two because the titular character today is very interwoven with that time period. And, you know, you have to think without the French Revolution going on, his circumstances would have been totally different, you know? So it's,
yeah, my experience of learning history, I think the French Revolution was one of the first things that I realized I could locate in American history, which I already knew a lot better. I'm talking about, you know, as a younger person.
Sure, sure. And it's what you're taught in school.
It's what you're taught in school. And you can say, oh, this was happening simultaneous, or this was influenced by it. But I never became a French Revolution expert or any of those wars. They're all part of that 100 years of European wars where you think, who's fighting who again now? The Italians are fighting. Yeah. Where, the British and French are at it again.
Yeah. And why this time? And
yeah, exactly.
Oh,
and then sort of like putters along. And how many Napoleons were there?
Yeah.
So for sure, it's
Napoleonic
a
Napoleonic Wars period.
Yeah. When people refer to a time within the context of the Napoleonic Wars or between whatever, 1800 and 1848. I always have a vague sense of who the good guys and who the bad guys were, but you know, the good guy, who are the good guys?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
And the Tsar?
I mean, you know what? Yeah, right. There's no good guys. Right. You can usually kind of picture it, like, okay, you can picture cavalry charges and you can picture, you know, roughly uniforms at the time, you know, and of course, you know, it's there's a certain look to it, you know, in paintings and whatnot, I think, that's kind of, you know, permeated. There's definitely a romanticism there. So, but yeah, aside from the details are, get very, very, you know, very list heavy. Get very, then this happened, then this happened, then that happened. But it's where do you start? Where do you end? Kind of thing.
Well, so Dumas is a lion of the French literary canon. But what's his connection to the Napoleonic Wars?
I guess we'll get right to it there.
He's born into it, right?
Yeah. So his father fought in some of them. His father was also named Alexandre Dumas. So it's a little confusing when you're trying to do the genealogy because everyone has the same name. The writer Dumas' son is also Alexander Dumas. So it's it becomes you've got three generations all with the same name there.
And am I right that the writer becomes Alexander Dumas the father, and his son is Alexander Dumas the son, but Alexander Dumas the father has also a notable father.
Correct. Yeah. Yep. Correct. And his father there is again Thomas Alexander Dumas, Davy de la Pietri, if you want to give his full name there. And I should have warned you ahead of time on this, but this is probably the worst topic for me to pick because I don't speak French and it's riddled with French names and places and whatnot. So when I'm writing my notes on this,
Alexandre.
Yeah. So if I go in and out trying to pronounce a few things in French and then back to English version, that's why.
Well, I think got it. You know, knowing a little bit about the futureling community and it has a kind of global scope, yeah. your light Gulf Coast lilt, I think people are going to appreciate very much, and you convey a very regional American energy. So
perfect. Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's a long history of mispronouncing things on the show, right? It's fine.
Oh, that's right. That's my stock and trade, right?
That's right. That's right.
Can't say a damn thing.
Yeah. So yeah.
Also,
so,
I just not to interrupt, but I know that futurelings who are watching this on YouTube are going to be very curious about your dog.
Okay.
Who keeps appearing on the couch and then taking a little walk and then coming back. What can you tell us about your dog?
Yeah, that's our dog Gabby. She's a rescue lab pit mix. She's very sweet. She actually lays on the back of our couch. She thinks she's half cat. So you see her getting on the couch and then getting on like the top of the couch to look out the windows. Yeah, she's perches herself up there. I don't know how she's like 65 pounds. Like you do not fit up there on the couch. But that's
well,
her.
She's ruining the couch.
Yeah,
clearly.
Yeah. We're gonna burn through couches at this rate. But no, she's very sweet. I'm sure you'll hear some more about this.
And you had a cat too.
Yeah.
I saw.
We do have a cat that walks around in the back. Yeah, he's an indoor outdoor, so he's out there sometimes, and he's also very pushy. You'll hear him meow sometimes.
All right. Well, good. I knew that people watching it were going to be like, when are you going to talk about the dog? It's all we care about now.
Yeah, right. But about that dog.
One thing I've learned as I've gotten older is just how different we are from one another, emotionally, intellectually, physically. And yet there are so many instances in life where we try to apply a cookie cutter approach to solving problems. You know, what works for me isn't necessarily going to work for you. And one of the big ways that we do this is in healthcare, in the way that we treat our bodies. You know, it's assumed that none of us should eat carbs, that none of us should have a glass of wine. And in fact, it's absolutely not just more than likely, but demonstrable that we each have very different physical needs in the same way that we have different emotional needs. And I think a really interesting new way that I'm kind of pursuing understanding this better is by tracing my biomarkers in blood tests that normally I would just sort of, you know, do the usual like cholesterol, high blood pressure, diabetes, you know, just give me the top level rundown. But in fact, I'm also trying to eat better, eat more nutritiously, but I'm trying to basically solve a problem and I don't know what the problem is. I mean, I can try keto or paleo or fasting, just kind of hoping, shooting at a target, just hoping that I hit it. But food isn't just fuel. It works with or against my genes or my hormones. And am I low in magnesium? Am I low in vitamin D? What does that actually mean? And how am I supposed to adjust my diet or my behavior to compensate it? And that's why, since I've been focusing on my nutrition more and trying to improve my overall health, I'm so excited about function. And it's not until you actually see your biomarkers that you understand what your body truly needs. The marvelous thing about function is you get access to over 160
of the most critical lab tests that cover everything from heart health, hormones, metabolism, nutrients, toxins. It tests your inflammation. It discovers and reports on stress markers. You can add MRI and chest CT imaging. It's all tracked in one secure place over time. And it's supported by super duper health leaders like Dr. Mark Hyman, Dr. Andrew Huberman, Dr. Jeremy London. They're all behind Function. Once you have your data, everything changes. You stop guessing. You start eating for your biology. You can be precise and choose the foods that actually address what your body needs, because food ultimately is the best medicine. So Function isn't cheap. It's not a, it's not just like a sign up and forget it or buy it once for $5, but Omnibus is offering you the opportunity to get a major, major discount on the price of Function. You can own your health for only $365 a year. That's a dollar a day. So if you use the Omnibus link, you go to functionhealth.com/omnibus. Use the gift code Omnibus25 for a $25 credit toward your membership. So that's $365 a year, a dollar a day. Use the code Omnibus25 for a $25 credit toward your membership. I have my Function membership, and I am having my tests done as we speak. And I'm super excited to take this new kind of leap into understanding my own physiology and what my body needs. So join me at Function, functionhealth.com/omnibus. Here we are, Alexander Dumas the First.
The First, yeah. So he was actually born as a slave to on Saint-Domingue. His father was the Marquis Davy de la Pietre from a French family, obviously. He had two other brothers. They'd all three joined the military. One of his brothers had moved to Saint-Domingue there, to present-day Haiti, and kind of married into a Creole family, and had started working with a sugar plantation. His wife's family had a sugar plantation there. That was, if you think of cotton around the Civil War time as being the big crop in the Southeast, sugar in the islands was the same kind of level of it run the economy at the time. For
right, because they could make rum out of it, right?
Yeah, and rum too in this time period. So kind of became kind of wealthy. This is also a time period where in France and other parts of Europe, you have that kind of mixing of blue blood and people that have just recently become rich, nouveau riche, whatever you want to call them. You know, you've got folks that have a title or landed for that, you know, from a what would be, I guess, a well-known family at the time. But they're maybe running out of money a little bit. Lifestyle's kind of caught up to them. Economy's changed, whatever. Revolutions obviously happening around the world at the time. So they're looking to increase their fortune. So they're looking to, you know, marry their kids off into families that maybe aren't aristocratic, but have the money. And, you know, you've seen that numerous times.
Sure, me too. That's when I look at my own retirement, I'm like, well, my daughter is charming. So, yeah, well, maybe that's going to help.
How many princes are there in Monaco? Come on, there's got to be a few more, right? So, yeah, so his brother sets up on the island there. Thomas Alexander's father, again, his name, the middle name to keep him separate is Antoine. So it's Alexander Antoine, Davy de la Pietre. Wouldn't be Dumas yet. That comes in later. But he comes in to the story after his brother's been there a few years. Kind of freeloads off his brother a little bit. You know, yeah, he's helping out and what he can. But again, he's aristocratic family. So let's how much is he really probably doing? Aside from spending the money, right?
Is he a young kind of ne'er-do-well just
yeah,
out?
Yeah, yeah. I think of him reading about him and seems to be like, maybe he's the Cato Kalin of the story. If everybody, I think we're all Gen Xers. a lot of folks remember that. So, you know, he's on the couch maybe. But they have a falling out. So Antoine takes a couple of enslaved folks that he has with him to kind of the western side of the island there, and sets up shop there, and is basically not really heard from again for decades. The namesake of the family, a marquis in France, passes away. The other two brothers move back to France, try to start, you know, maybe making a fortune there, bringing in their title into play. Again, France is starting to kind of see the beginnings of revolution, maybe starting to peak up there and you know, the late 1700s there. And they try a couple of different money-making schemes, for lack of a better word. One of them marries off, just as you just hinted at, marries off his daughter to someone who's got some more money. The bridegroom thinks that he's getting into a family that's wealthy and vice versa, but the reality is both of them are kind of broke.
Well, you know, that happened in my grandparents met in France in World War I, and I think they both kind of hoodwinked the other into thinking that they were marrying into a family with substantial means. And it was only after they were married and got back to the United States that they realized, wait a minute, I thought you had money. It was, it actually, you know, had a very shaping effect on my personality as the trauma reverberated through time.
Yeah. So they go back, try to break up the title. One of them gets in trouble with the military, trying to sell some supplies, and is kind of you know, unceremoniously let go, and kind of a scandal. His other brother tries to actually get involved with the slave trade, but
Wait, wasn't it illegal yet in France? Or
not quite? Yeah, there's a very in France proper, yes, at the time, but on the islands, of course, that was what was running the economy. So there was a very, very sort of gray area, I feel like. And even in France at the time, before the revolutionary period, you've got, it's legal, but you also have a lot of free men walking around too as well, that, you know, maybe it's a little bit like today where it's illegal, but it's definitely, you know, some people aren't going to treat you like a normal, normal person in that society kind of thing. They're going to recognize you as being an outsider kind of thing. So
I think slavery is on the main, mostly illegal around the world now. Although yeah. as you might guess, there
sure,
are
yeah.
still pockets of it, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if it's true or not, but you can see statistics that there's actually more people enslaved now than there were in any other point in history. It's just that we don't know about it as much. And
you know, there are more people.
Yeah. Yeah, more people too. And you've got a lot of rural areas and countries that, you know, look the other way or depending on it for whatever reason. So I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what I read.
Yeah, it seems like the type of statistic that would shock and dismay you. But then when you think of all the ways that you can be indentured.
Right, yeah.
And have it not be exactly, you know, bound in chains, but
yeah,
indentured in 100 other ways.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So both of the brothers basically end up also, you know, kind of losing the fortune there. The brother that tried his hand in the slave trade also tried some smuggling through some nearby ports there, actually on the Spanish side of the island Hispaniola. And there was a little small island that he would use to smuggle his stuff, which at the time was called Monte Cristo. So Dumas picked that kind of little fact out of his family history and decided to use that. And as you'll see, there's a lot of little things kind of throughout his family history he used for inspiration in several of his works.
Now that I'm thinking about it, you know, I always think of a Monte Cristo as being a fried sandwich. But doesn't it mean Christ Mountain?
I think so. Yeah, it would make sense, right? Yeah, Christ. No. Hill, Mount, whatever. Yeah, yeah.
Christ
yeah.
Hill?
Yeah, yeah, something like that. But yeah, the two brothers are kind of on the outs there. They're on the way downhill kind of economically and socially. And then the long-lost third brother who had fled decides to come back to France and start to claim his title that he is owed. He's the last surviving brother at the time. The other two have since passed. So
he becomes Marquis.
The heir apparent, the Marquis, correct. Yep. He In the meantime, he has sold off all of his property, including several of his own children that he had had with a woman he had purchased named, her last name was Dumas. So that's where our count gets his name at some point. He takes his mother's maiden name. Antoine has sold his property, including several of his children that he had with a woman that he had purchased named Mary Celeste Dumas. Who would be our title characters here's mother as well. And he had a fourth child as well, that he didn't sell right away. He kept him. And just as he was about to leave to France, apparently he was maybe running out of money. So he sells, him as well, but with the right to repurchase him, when he got the means. So,
wow. The this is just such strange language.
Yeah. It's like mind blowing, you know, as you have kids, you know, I can't imagine selling any of my kids on most days anyway.
Right. And then there are those days where you're like, how much could I get for this kid?
Exactly.
But still, yeah, dark times.
Dark times for sure, yeah. The author Tom Rees, who wrote a book on the subject here, I'd like to just give him credit for it. He puts it in a fantastic way that he sold most of his other children, but he only pawned Thomas Alexander. So he wanted to get him back.
He saw something in his youngest son. Where he was
maybe it was guilt. Who knows? But yeah. Mm-hmm. So he gets back to France, finally gets a little more money up now that he's the Marquis. And again, he's definitely a schemer. He's got it with his brother's daughter, so it'd be his niece has married someone, again thinking maybe both of them are getting some into a wealthy family. Kind of takes advantage of them, you know, thinks that he can flip their estate and whatnot to get money back.
And was there an estate or like a did the Marquis inherit?
Yeah, he had an estate, so you know, in various other properties. And over time, Antoine ends up basically selling it piece by piece and then eventually outright to kind of fund his lifestyle. He does repurchase Thomas Alexander back, brings him to France, and then basically starts trying to make up for lost time. Eventually ends up selling the estate outright for like an annuity to I guess it'd be his nephew-in-law. And then him and young Thomas moved to Paris, and he starts getting Thomas trained and the classics. I mean, trying to have a formal education, catch up to it. His father has him enrolled in the La Boissière Academy. Mm-hmm. And trained under the Chevalier St. George, which was at the time a very famous fencer and a composer, as well as just an all around kind of swashbuckling person of him and himself.
And was Alexander at this point, did he read as a black person? I mean, was he very much identifiable, noticeable as a person of African descent?
Yeah, definitely. And at the time, this kind of neoclassicism time period in French and French culture, you have an era that it's exoticized, but in kind of a classical way, where maybe France was seeing itself as the new Rome or something, the new Constantinople, is this really cosmopolitan place on a historical stage, and we've got people from everywhere that are living with us. So it was.
So he was called the Moor or something.
Yeah, it would have definitely been
orientalized.
Yes, exactly. It would have been, look how grand this person is and how exotic he looks. And but at the same time, there definitely would have been an undertone of, racism, which I'm sure we could all, appreciate even today. So
right. But that's interesting to think of France at the time and now.
Yeah.
I think having a very different relationship to multi-ethnicity than maybe even London, certainly Berlin.
Sure. Yeah. But yeah, so he does definitely read as someone of color, black. They use the word Creole a lot, which doesn't necessarily mean black. It just means someone born in the islands at the time. So you could have a person that all European blood that was still considered Creole, although nowadays
Alexander Hamilton.
But today we kind of think of that more as being a black infused type thing.
Sure. But, a mixture of races.
Sure. Yeah. But not at the time period, but yeah. And that's actually one of the first kind of thing we have in Thomas Alexander's, handwriting. He gets into a little bit of a scuffle. He's at a play or a show with a young Creole woman who's white. And there's a white naval officer who recognizes her and, you know, is trying to like pretend that Thomas is just her lackey or a servant kind of thing. And, you know, she couldn't possibly be romantically interested in this man. And so him and his friends kind of rough him up a little, want him to kind of, you know, like beg for mercy. And he doesn't, gets into a scuffle, and he writes out a police statement to the effect that, you know, here's what happened. I was escorting this young lady about town kind of thing. And he signs that police report as Alexander Dumas. So that's kind of the first time we see him use that appellate there.
But so Dumas at this point is living in an aristocratic society as a young aristocrat. So he's not, there isn't a cultural kind of impediment or wall that would keep him out of aristocratic society, despite the fact that he's kind of other.
Correct. Yeah. He's definitely included, I guess you would say, in that kind of upper society.
In the court.
Yeah. Just to go back and kind of read, he signs it, Dumas Davy is how he signs that affidavit. So he's using, first time he uses his mom's name as his last, his name, the Dumas, and then his dad's last name. He combines the last names there.
It becomes a kind of nom de guerre.
Again, it's a kind of a time that you think of places that you could be as a person who definitely looked black in that time period. And this would probably be one of your better options, you know, France at the time, if you're talking about living in the West, at least, you know.
But he was trained as a chevalier, trained by like a knight and a fencer. Was he engaged in any duels?
We'll skip ahead a little bit there. Thomas enters the French military as a private in 1786. He's 24 at the time. His dad is still alive for a few more months at least. Antoine says, "Well, you're not going to join the military as a private and then drag our family name kind of down at the lower class ranks of the enlisted man. You know, that can't be done." So he makes him enlist under a nom de guerre, fake name there. And that's the first time where he does use the Thomas Alexander Dumas as his name.
Oh, so his original incarnation deserts the French military and he reenlists under a different name as an officer.
Well, no, he just enlists as that. His dad just forbade him to enlist using the family's name because he didn't want the name to be, as he called it, drugged down to the level of the enlisted man when they were supposed to be an aristocratic family.
Oh, I see. So he does enlist as a private, just not as...
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. But under a false name there.
I see.
Yeah. So he enlists with the 6th Regiment of the Queen's Dragoons. And the Dragoons are, you know, they're not cavalry. They fight with horses, but not on horseback. You know, the horse is just to get you from one place to the other to then dismount and fight. You know, it's, you know, helicopter cavalry today. Think of it that way. A lot of, you know, it's just moving the troops around. But they're definitely as a scouting unit, kind of a first in to scout the area and then a last out to cover the retreat kind of thing. So he sees a lot of action with the Dragoons around the same time. You know, we're 1786 here. We're creeping up to the French Revolution, and that really gives Thomas a chance to make a name for himself throughout this time period.
Yeah, would the Queen's Regiment have been referring to Marie Antoinette? Would she have been the Queen?
I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question. And maybe it was just a historical regiment. There's some other historical queen, or would it have been Antoinette herself? You know, I don't know what the history is of that unit. Would be interesting to see if it was a historical unit or not.
Yeah, probably was a historical unit, but the queen inherits, right? The new queen would have been the titular queen, as you say.
Yeah, sure. But while he's in the military, there's kind of a legend of his kind of prowess and his strength kind of just, you know, balloons. And it's one of those things where there's probably a basis of truth here, but it's a little unbelievable. He fights 3 duels in one day and only suffers a small gash, besting all of them, which, again, that's in the kind of, Three Musketeers, you know, you have D'Artagnan doing that same feat. So again, taking some kind of tales from soldiers there, soldiers' tales. There's a story of him being able to pit, four musket, like pistols, in his fingers, like put a finger down the barrel of each musket and then lift it up without, you know, bending his wrist kind of thing. So he's got like four of these heavy pistols just with his fingers in the barrel, lifting it up. So seems a little far-fetched. My personal favorite is that he was such a good horseman and so strong. And he was 6'1" at a time when most people were like 5'5". So he stood out for his height alone, much less, you know, looking black in a European society as well. So he was such a good horseman that he could ride his horse around a covered arena and then come to a beam and then grab the beam above his head and then wrap his legs around the horse and lift himself and the horse up off the ground, which really starts to strain credulity there.
It does.
Yes.
And are these legends about him, are these retconned by his son and that literary reputation, or were these kind of legends about him in his own time?
Yeah, I think legend in his own time. His son definitely wrote his biography and attributes it to tales from, you know, various sources that, that he had, had talked to, you know, compatriots at the time kind of thing and whatnot. So you definitely get the biographers hearing it secondhand, and it's his father, of course, so he wants to maybe embellish it a little bit. But at some point you have to be like, wait a minute, you had to have known this. that's not going to happen, you know. I don't care how my wife, my my daughter, I'm sorry, rides horses, so she's I'm around horses a lot. I'm like, that's a little too hard to believe.
Yeah. Well, as someone who has tried to lift only two pistols by putting my fingers in the barrels, I can attest it's very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, and that, you know, it's one of those things. He probably did one or two, and then the next year, it's he needed three, and then as the story embellished, it gets better and better, you know. That gets us up through, you know, kind of his first times as getting into the military. And then the next kind of intervening thing is, you know, the French Revolution really starts. And I know you've obviously spent a lot of time in Europe, John. I don't know if you know more about that, obviously, than some of us.
Well, as a student, right, you can't avoid the French Revolution, especially if you're a student of America. It keeps coming up. But yeah, right, it would have been, he was in the military already and had been participating in European wars, and then the revolution happens. This is kind of a trick, right? Your allegiance now is in question.
Correct, yeah. Yeah, and that comes into play a lot, actually. You know, anyone in the military before, and especially if you move up to an officer class, if you were an officer before the revolution, how much could the revolution trust you? Because again, that would have been an aristocratic corps at the time. But yeah, you've got the meeting of States General, storming of the Bastille on July 14th. And then you have this period in July and August of 1789, kind of known as the Great Fear. And that's where you've got just, you know, open revolt. So every little town and village is kind of scared of roving mobs of bandits. Maybe it's the revolutionaries coming, and if you're more of an aristocratic type town, you're afraid. Or maybe it's just bandits claiming they're revolutionaries and opportunists in that. So Thomas and his unit, they're deployed to the town of Villacotier. Again, apologies for probably butchering that, but he's deployed there, called in by their National Guard of that kind of area, Claude Labouret. And while he gets there, he makes an impression on Claude's daughter, Mary Louise, and she actually writes to one of her friends about how the dragoons have come into town, and there's one striking and handsome young gentleman that's kind of caught her eye. You can tell by the letter that she's definitely mentioning him a little more than you would if she hadn't caught her eye in a certain way. So he becomes engaged to Julie later on that year in December, but his soon-to-be father-in-law only makes one request of him, that he wait until he becomes a sergeant before they actually have the wedding, because at this time he's still just an enlisted. I think he's a corporal at this time. So he wants him to become at least a sergeant to show that he's, you know, he's capable and whatnot and going to be able to provide. And as we'll see, he far outstrips that requirement from his soon-to-be father-in-law.
And is this common at the time in the military, do you think, where, because I know it's uncommon in our current time that someone would start as a private and have the opportunity and the ambition to advance all the way into being an officer?
Yeah, I think most definitely. I mean, you know, you think of, especially nowadays, you know, someone who's an officer is going to, you know, probably not come up through an enlisted rank. They may come up enlisted and then go to OCS or something and then become an officer. But, you know, most officers are coming out of an academy or an ROTC program or, you know, some kind of college program and going to OCS and then becoming an officer. And even if they were, you're talking about, you know, years to go from one to the other. You know, if you're starting out as enlisted, Thomas rises very quickly in revolutionary France, which you've got to think that also has a big part of it because you've got people on both sides fighting each other. So there's definitely room for advancement there. But he rises up to kind of the head of the military, the topper rank of the military in a little over a year. So that's, you know, goes from enlisted man to general in a year. So it's
in a year.
It's yeah.
I mean, you know, there's usually like a wartime commission. You end up being a captain when you, and then after the war, you kind of get bumped back down to your lieutenant status or whatever, and maybe all the way up to a major, but he goes from a private to a general in a year.
Yeah. And again, it's not just like straight up through the ranks. There's reasons, which we'll get to that, you know, throughout the revolutionary causes.
Well, as I've said before, I have started taking GLP-1s. I'm not ashamed to say it because they've been marvelous for me in terms of kind of quieting food noise. But what it has really pointed out to me is that now that I'm eating less garbage and less constantly, I need to eat more mindfully and need to eat better when I do eat. And that's why I'm so pleased with Factor meals. Their quality, they've got lots of lean ingredients, like they've got a great vegetable selection, they're whole foods, they've got healthy fats, no refined sugars, no artificial sweeteners, no refined seed oil. Basically, they're like a one-stop shop for me to eat more healthily, to manage calories, to get more protein, which is a real issue with GLP-1s. And I have enjoyed every Factor meal I've gotten, which, you know, I'm not the world's pickiest eater, but I also don't like everything. And every Factor meal, even ones where I was like, I'm not sure I would have chosen these vegetable courses, for instance, I'm so glad when I actually start eating it, like how delicious it is, and I feel great about it. When I'm done, there's over 100 rotating weekly meals. You can choose high protein. You can choose Mediterranean. There's even a GLP-1 support menu. There's ready to eat salads. And there's a variety called Muscle Pro. If you're like really digging into being like all, you know, like going for it. But it's not all bro coded like that. There's incredible food across the whole spectrum of delicious meals. It's always fresh. It doesn't come frozen. It's like it is ready to go in about 2 minutes. Like you get it, put it in the zapper, 2 minutes later, hot and fresh and like delicious. No prep, no stress. So here's what you do. You go to factormeals.com/omnibus. 50 off and use the code omnibus 50 off, one word, one construction, omnibus 50 off to get, guess what, 50% off your first Factor box plus free breakfast for a year. This offer is only valid for new Factor customers with the code and qualifying auto renewing subscription purchase. Make healthier eating easy with Factor, and thank you again for using the code when you go to Factor. It helps Factor recognize that Omnibus is their number one portal for new customers because I love Factor so much. Do you ever wake up in the middle of the night like either too hot or too cold in your bed. Like, nothing is grosser than waking up in the middle of the night sweaty, but also how lame to wake up in the middle of the night shivering. There are so many kind of ways that we try to manage our beds, and it's not as easy as it seems. And that's why I'm here to recognize and to recommend Miracle Made sheets. They are temperature regulating. They're inspired by NASA technology. They use silver infused fabrics, and this kind of regulating quality the silver infused fabrics have, in my experience using Miracle Made sheets, I get a very restful sleep. Also, that silver, you know, is like bacteria inhibiting. And as a bachelor, I'm not going to say that I change my sheets every 3 days. Let's be honest. I'm not going to say I change them every 4 days. And yet I'm confident that the allergens, the gross little invisible critters that live in all of our sheets, are being neutralized by the NASA-inspired silver-infused fabrics. So these are some of the many reasons I recommend Miracle Made sheets, including that they are very luxurious. They feel like the kind of sheets that you might find at a five-star hotel, but they're not expensive. They're not overpriced expensive like a lot of those super luxe sheets are. So I recommend to you that you join me in my Miracle Made journey and get yourself some silver-infused Miracle Made sheets by going to trymiracle.com/omnibus. You'll save over 40% off of the Miracle Made sheets that just the regular normies are getting. And when you use the promo code omnibus, you'll get an extra 20% off that 40% off, plus a free 3-piece towel set. And I should add, even though Christmas season is behind us, President's Day is approaching, and these make an amazing gift, and they come with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk to you. That's trymiracle.com/omnibus, code omnibus at checkout. Thanks to you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring the omnibus.
The revolution's happening. He's there defending kind of the borderland between Belgium, which at the time is aligned with Austria. So it's Austria-Belgian coalition, and the French border there. So he's, you know, northeast France, basically, trying to fight off raids and whatnot up in that area. His first kind of real big recorded claim to fame with the military happens in August of 1792. He's a corporal, and he's leading a small kind of four-man scouting mission near the town of Mald, and he comes upon like an Austrian raiding party, and he kind of like Han Solos it, I think is the best way. In original Star Wars, you know, he's chasing the stormtroopers around the corner, and all of a sudden there's a bunch of them. It's kind of one of those situations. His four men party kind of surprised these guys, and they start attacking them. They flee across like a little ditch, river, ravine, which
he says, Chewie, get us out of here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They flee back across the ravine. Or like I say, ravine, but more of like a stream, river, the way it's described. His other members of his scouting party there is in his unit, they're not as good a horseman. That kind of stops them, like, as far as we're going. He's able to jump or get the horse across in whatever way, chases them, and ends up basically capturing this little small force of men, about a dozen people just by himself. and is commended for it. Prisoners were kind of rare back then. You know, they either fled or you died on the battlefield kind of deal. So it's a big deal. The local newspaper at the time writes about it. And he kind of becomes a minor celebrity kind of for this little action that takes place.
Right. That's pretty great. Okay. So yeah. he's not just promoted administratively, he's showing real valor.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. His skill on the battlefield becomes, you know, not just in the back. he's definitely seen as a lead from the front kind of commander, person in command there. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that ends up again giving him some credit there. The actual, you know, French Revolution, as you know, it's not just immediately, you know, guillotines and we're off kind of thing. It's a slow workup process. The monarchy's kind of still around, but doesn't have much power at the time this happens. But eventually that gets abolished as well. And the Free French Republic is officially born in September of 1792. So now there's not even the pretext of a monarchy. We're straight up into the French Republic at the time.
But we're not, but Napoleon isn't yet commanding the army.
Correct. Correct. Yeah, he's still a soldier. You know, he's an artilleryman at the time. He's an officer, obviously, and commanding some troops. But he's not Napoleon as we think of Napoleon quite yet, you know. but with the advent of the French Republic being born, it opened up the option for a lot of other things to change in the military. One of them was the establishment of legions. So, you know, think of like the French Foreign Legion being famous for its thing. This allows France to kind of bring up the French Republic, rather, to bring up these legions that aren't necessarily tied directly to the military, but are still fighting alongside the military. You know, they're kind of operating alongside, but with them. And one of them wants to be established is a free Black Legion of soldiers. Free in this case, meaning free from the military. But of course, if you've got Black soldiers, freedom means kind of a two-edged word there.
So these were like these were mercenary kind of.
It would have just been citizens at the time, possibly mercenaries, but you know, other members that were already in military units that wanted to do maybe something else. You know. So you kind of get a bidding war between these couple of legions for Thomas Alexander. He's kind of known throughout the soldierdom for being just kind of a general badass, for lack of a better word. And then his mauled action there has made him a little kind of minor hero, minor celebrity there. So you get kind of a bidding war between two of these legions that want to be primarily Black recruits. Originally, there's the Free Legion of America in the South that wants him to come aboard with them, and they're going to make him, I think, a lieutenant. And then there's another legion that's headed by the Chevalier St. George, who, of course, had trained Thomas when he was younger. He already knew him and his abilities. He's formed the Hussars of Liberty and Equality, which I can't think of a more, like, you know, Napoleonic era title for the Hussars of Liberty and Equality. You know, it's got a you can picture the hats, you know,
right? Liberté, Equalité.
Yeah.
So the other group was called it had America in the title. What were they actually fighting in French America?
At the time, American at the time in France would have just meant somebody from the colonies, probably Black. So, you know, kind of similar to Creole, but definitely had the Black connotation. So it was an American kind of thing, you know, it was exotic again. So he ends up with the Hussars of Liberty because they're going to give him a higher commission. He agrees to be the first lieutenant for the Hussars, so he gets promoted from corporal to lieutenant by joining that legion. So that's a pretty big jump right there. You're already skipped over all the enlisted ranks right up to lieutenant. The Hussars want him to be their first lieutenant. But then St. George, with his Free Legion of Americans of the South, he counters and makes him a lieutenant colonel, so his second in command.
What?
Yeah.
Well, and what's interesting, right, is he grew up in enough in society that he would have had the manners of an officer. He would have been
correct.
Able to...
Yep.
To be in that world comfortably.
He would have had all of the trappings, I guess you could say, to be in that. So yeah, and you know, again, the Chevalier was the commander of that legion. So he already knew him from training him, knew how well he was, and of course he was like I said, a minor celebrity at the time. So they kind of, hey, we're having an all black legion, we want this guy on it because he's kind of the most famous, you know, Black troop we have at the time. So they definitely want him on their side. So he does end up there with the Black Legion. He then ends up, he marries Mary Louise in 1792 back in Villacotier. So he's, you know, his father-in-law wanted to be a sergeant. Well, he's second in command and a lieutenant colonel. So he's definitely, you know, well surpassed what the prerequisite there. And yeah, so then French Revolution is continuing. Of course, King Louis loses his head in January of 1793. So then you've got, you know, kind of that era of the of the French Revolution starting to fire up. And then, of course, by the by the spring, you've got the Reign of Terror kind of officially starting, where the Committee of Public Safety and people are being denounced and beheaded kind of in mass there. While all this is going on, Thomas Alexander is back in northeast France along the Belgian frontier in a town called Mold. And he's just constantly sent out on outposts and leading patrols. And there's reports of him, you know, he captures a 14 men and a post of 40 soldiers. So his reputation's kind of growing, just taking prisoners and capturing these little forts and in these little like cross border actions back and forth with the Black Legion there. But with the Reign of Terror kind of comes a grand opportunity. He's promoted to the armies of the North in January of 1793, where he's been promoted from a dragoon corporal to a brigadier general in about a year. So now he's up to brigadier general. 1 month later, he's made general of division. So he's commanding 10,000 men by the summer of that year.
And who are they fighting on the Belgian frontier? Are they fighting Austrians?
It would have been, yeah, Belgium aligned with Austria at the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, or as a colony of. And then he is appointed commander-in-chief of the Army of the Western Pyrenees to fight against Spain. And then, so the Army of the Western Pyrenees is... has had kind of a Darth Vader situation kind of going on, where they've gone through four generals in the past few months. So Thomas Alexander comes on as like the fourth or fifth one. So it's one of those, you're the general now. Oh, you're not doing what we need. You're out. You're the general. You're out. You know? So it's very much a command that may be seen as a little risky at the time. But he does succeed. And in the winter of 1793-94, Thomas is once again transferred, this time as commander of the Army of the Alps, which is, again, he's the general there.
Now fighting the Italians.
Fighting the Italians, yep. And it's five large departments spread across the mountains. Of course, that's not exactly a nice, easy plane that you could form up in these kind of typical Napoleonic war type fashion. It's finding mountain passes and mountain forts and whatnot while he's the commander there. And this is kind of the high point of his career, really. This is as commander of this army. He becomes the general of the Army of the Alps there in 1793, 1794. The next time a person of color gets to be that high of a rank in a Western society is Colin Powell, when he becomes chairman of the Joint Chiefs in 89 or 90.
No kidding.
Yeah.
And again, 200 years later.
Yeah. Depending on how you want to call the ranks, you know, is that the exact equivalent rank, or is it just the highest general? If you want to say it's just the highest general, then he's the first person of color to attain that highest general rank since until Chappie does in the 70s as the Air Force general. So still, you're only about another decade or so between those two in the grand scheme. But yeah, literally, you know, 150 years later.
And there were other black generals in the French army kind of in that period, right? The Napoleonic era. It wasn't entirely unknown.
Sure. There would have had to have been, I would think. Yeah. Especially with forming those Black Legions, you would have had to, well, Chevalier himself, he was a general at the time. And when he hired, recruited Dumont into that Legion. So, you know, he would have been one as well. But yeah, it definitely wouldn't have been the only one, but, certainly the one that was making the name for himself the most kind of in society.
Right.
Yeah. So, the Army of the Alps there is fighting, you know, trying to open up passes into Italy, which then, of course, would open up an invasion on into Italy proper. He takes place in a battle near Mount Cenis, takes a pass, the Petit Saint Bernard Pass as well, and then ends up fighting for the actual fort at the Mount Cenis as well. And it's sort of a Guns of the Navarone type situation, where there's really, you know, it's a heavily defended fort at the top of mountains. It's defended on one side by just an ice cliff. So it's very, very protected kind of uphill battle the whole way. But he does lead his army into victory, and they do end up capturing the fort.
And this was what year?
This is in February 1794.
Okay, so still Napoleon is not yet leading the First Republic.
Correct. Whatever. Yeah, yeah. Napoleon is actually at the time he is
also in Italy, though. Wouldn't he
is
he
in Italy. He is with the army of Italy, and he actually the first correspondence we have between Napoleon and Thomas Alexandra is during this time period. Actually, Napoleon writes to Thomas Alexandra requesting some cannons. He wants more cannons, being an artilleryman. That's not surprising. He wants more cannons, but Thomas rejects him. Basically, says, "You know, I need my cannons. I'm trying to attack this pass and attack this fort." So,
right, Alexander would have been his superior officer
at the time. It would have been outranking him. Yes. Yeah. Or at minimum equivalent, again, depending on, you know, how you want to divide up the ranks at the time. But yeah. But in a totally different unit. Yeah.
Right.
So it's his kind of first slight against Napoleon, strike one that he doesn't really forget.
If somebody denies you cannons, I mean, that is, talk about revenge fantasy.
Yeah, right.
You're like, one day I'm going to get those cannons.
I'm going to get those cannons one way or the other. Right? Yeah. Because of this, now Thomas is, you know, Thomas Alexander de Mather, he's become kind of a celebrity. He's the hero of the Alps. He's opened up the pass into Italy. He's constantly kind of having to defend his actions and sometimes inactions because, you know, the weather in the Alps in the winter and spring isn't exactly the best to try to launch an offensive against. So he's constantly getting letters from the Committee of Public Safety you need to do something now or we're going to pull you as well. And he keeps kind of paying them off. When he's finally successful, though, they write to him and they want him to report back to Paris for questioning kind of thing. Again, like you said earlier, like, well, you were in the army before the revolution and an aristocratic upbringing. So your allegiance is kind of questioned kind of deal. He pits him off, though, and delays his return, which may have saved his life because in the intervening time is, of course, the coup against Robespierre. So by the time he gets back to Paris, Robespierre has already been put to death for his reign of terror, and that's ending. So
that's a good excuse forestall the trip.
Yeah, exactly. So it definitely helps him out. Maybe that's the lesson there. You know, like maybe try to delay as much as you can. Sometimes if you think it's bad news, you never know what can play out in the meantime. You know,
sure.
In just a few weeks' time.
When they call me back to Washington, I'm definitely going to take the slow road.
Yeah. So. After his actions there, he's sent back into a different army. He just keeps getting moved around. Everyone kind of wants his prowess to lead their army. He's sent to the Army of the West in a campaign against the Catholic and Royal Army. These are royalists that are now revolting against the revolutionaries, revolting against the new republic in the Vendée region in France. So he gets there, and the army is kind of in an appalling shape. It's very corrupt. It's very, we'll sell our weapons for money. We're going to just, you know, the standard kind of rape and pillage as we traverse the area kind of thing. And he brings some order back to the army there and sets it back on the right track, and is actually thanked by the population there at the end for kind of reinstilling it and kind of protecting the lives and property of the citizens there, but through getting his army under control, Again, he's really making a name for himself there. He's already, you know, really, really up in the army. He ends up also being assigned to the Army of Italy before the siege of Minuta. And here he's stationed, actually, he's under Napoleon at this point. And again, this is another one where he gets there and he's kind of appalled by the nature of the army under Napoleon and kind of their lack of discipline with
right,
the populace.
Probably appalled by the paucity of cannon.
Back
to haunt him.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you guys should have asked for more cannons this whole time. Why did you ask for more cannons? He participates in the siege of Minuta there. It's kind of guarding the only last route over the Alps into Italy, as well as an east-western lane there between the Adriatic and the Mediterranean. So it's kind of a key crossroads town to be taken there. He catches a spy who he he interrogates, and of course the spy claims he doesn't know anything, but remembering some passages, he believes that the spy has actually swallowed some orders and like coated in like a wax pill or something like that. So he orders the spy under watch and guard until he passes the incriminating evidence, which he eventually does, and that kind of gives the army a leg up, because now they know where the Austrians and the Italians are going to try to be attacking them from.
A leg up, literally.
I don't know, you know, every job in the military probably, but guy watching the bowel movements of spy is pretty low on the list probably, right, of things you want, right, to be in the,
although in you have to military. Know what you're looking for, so yeah, it can't, you can't that. Just be yeah. some dummy,
right? yeah right So while he's undergoing that action, he ends up capturing prisoners as well. He has the fighting near the city of Klausen in Tyrol area, and he has kind of a glowing report from the one of Napoleon's other officers that he led the charge at the head of the cavalry units, and you know, personally killed several of the opponents with his own hands, of his powerful hand slicing down and whatnot. Napoleon's a little upset at this, even though the report and the local populace start calling Dumas the Black Devil for his actions and for leading the charge, and you know, which I can imagine, if you think you're going up against Frenchmen and this 6'1" tall black man is running at you with a saber and at the head of the column, you're probably a little taken aback. So they really makes his name for himself with the enemy as well, because they start to fear him. So yeah, Napoleon at this point though is really, really starting to see where he's getting overshadowed a little bit, you know, sometimes by Dumas. His report back to Paris omits the actions of Dumas, even though he knows from field reports that he's been at the head of the charge and capturing these prisoners and actions.
Catty Napoleon,
yeah. So he's already kind of starting to diminish his role from actually like leading the units to back to just observer kind of thing. So he's just like observing, and this really incenses Dumas, who I think he is said to have written back that if you were an observer in the position I was in, you would have shit your pants or something like that. So he definitely takes offense to it as well, as being left out of the kind of some of the official reports. But they do capture the fortified area there, and they do of course open up into Italy and proceed to sweep in. The next kind of really big area in his Thomas Alexander's life here is he is assigned to the Army of the Orient in 1798, and he's made commander of all of the dragoons and the chief of staff of the cavalry in the Army of the Orient. So this is, of course, you know, I think a lot of people think of Napoleon's army in Egypt. This is that army. Yeah, this is that Orient being just meaning Oriental at the time, and Napoleon had grand designs of taking this army from Egypt and then farther east all the way to India to harass the British. But the army in Egypt there really didn't go out as planned. They kind of stalled out very quickly, harassed by Admiral Nelson and the British trying to get into Alexandria. They do eventually make it to Alexandria, siege the city and take it. And then on their way to Cairo, they also engaged in various actions. And this is, they're in wool uniforms in the spring and summer of 1798, marching across Egypt without supplies, provisions. So, you know, just lack of water becomes the primary concern of the army, opposed to anything else.
No wonder they were shooting at the Sphinx.
Right. Yeah, and there's, of course,
all those obelisks.
Yeah, famous paintings of the Battle of the Pyramids at this time, you know, have the pyramids in the background. But, you know, the actual battle site was probably farther away. You wouldn't have been able to see the pyramids. But that doesn't look good on a painting. You know, if you're going to make a grand romantic painting of the battle in Egypt, you've got to have the pyramids in the background. You know, you're not going to leave those out. So they they eventually do make it to Cairo, kind of become an occupying force there. Napoleon is told the troops that, don't worry, this will be a quick campaign. We'll be seen as liberators, liberating the Egyptians from the Mamluk Turks. And we never hear that again. No other army has ever said that after this time period, of course.
No, that's right. It took a lot longer.
Yeah. So they end up in just an occupation of Cairo there. They're running short on supplies, but still, you know, a formidable force there. But Admiral Nelson does catch their fleet outside of Alexandria there, and basically decimates the French fleet. And that's really kind of the nail in the coffin for the Army of the Orient in Egypt. They're still there, but everyone's slowly kind of falling back. They don't have the ships now to get everyone back. And this is really why the this time period in Napoleon's time in Egypt is kind of really known, because they also brought a lot of scientists with them. So maybe there is a slight science angle here.
Right,
brought a lot of scientists with them, archaeologists and historians, mathematicians, that kind of thing.
This is the beginning of Egyptology.
Yeah, right? exactly, to catalog what they can find and bring back spoils, you know, back to France.
Was Dumas' reputation damaged by the military defeat?
Well, not really.
Or did that fall on Napoleon?
Yeah, not really, because it's kind of the beginning of the end for him, honestly. But this time in Egypt, they set up the Egyptian Institute. These scientists do, and they kind of become the problem solvers for Napoleon. How do we get water here? How do we get these people to survive? And that kind of knowledge and work is really what that expedition gets to be known for, because that's the only thing that really comes out of it that's a benefit. Napoleon does end up, he ends up just leaving Egypt kind of unceremoniously. Like, supposedly he doesn't even tell his second in command he's leaving. He's just up and gone one day and just goes back to France. Like, he's done with it, but he's fine just leaving the army there. Thomas Alexander has in one night in Cairo, I believe it was Cairo, sometime in that campaign, with a group of officers at dinner, and you've got to think there's probably maybe some wine or something going on as well. He kind of lets his opinion of Napoleon be known, that this was an ill-fated expedition and he's overextended himself, and, you know, really kind of talk smack about it, for lack of a better word. And of course, that gets back to Napoleon, who's now, he's got two strikes on him and already doesn't like him. So because of that, Thomas ends up trying to go back to France as well. Him and a compatriot, they book a passage on a ship called the Bella Maltese, which is a old corvette that's leaking and doesn't get far out of the harbor very far before they have to pit to shore. They pit to shore in Taranto, in southern, not Toronto, but Taranto.
Taranto, yeah.
In southern Italy, which they think is friendly
port. Which would have been unfriendly territory,
yes,
right?
Yes, they think it's friendly because it had some revolutionary zeal when they left, but it has since reverted back to the crown. So they're imprisoned. And here he's imprisoned for several years.
The Army of the Orient.
Yes, yeah. And they are holding him because they kind of see the writing on the wall as well. Napoleon stages his coup in November of 1799. He's now, you know, leader of the French Republic. Yeah, if you still want to call it a republic at this point. Right. And France's armies are once again on the march. So they're kind of holding him prisoner, kind of hedging their bets. There's a bargaining chip, you know, hey, right, if the army gets this far south, we've got something to look forward to. And the reports out of his prison time in his biography counts that as the time went on, kind of the different governors and different jailers that he had, their attitude changed toward him, and they kind of, what do you need? Is there anything we can make your stay? They kind of start sucking up to him a little bit, anticipating the eventual French master again.
He's going to be the boss in not very long.
Yeah. So he's there. Prison takes its toll. He's eventually released a couple years later in 1801, March 1801. He's blind in one eye, deaf in one ear. Half of his face is kind of half paralyzed. He thinks his jailers have been poisoning him at some point. And of course, this becomes his son's, you know, impetus for Edmond Dumas spending his time in jail. he does eventually, you know, make it back to France and do his wife. But things just kind of go back on downhill. Napoleon is, they write letters to the Republic and to Napoleon himself. And they're just blown off. Nothing is ever given to him. His pension is never paid. Napoleon walks back some of the more liberal race laws that France had had at the time. In May of 1802, there's new race laws issued that, that kind of open up the door to slavery again in the territories. 1803, interracial marriage is outlawed, and Dumas has to get a kind of special recompense to even live in the city he's at as a black man. So he goes from hero to the Republic to prisoner to, you know, kind of outcast, you know, within just a few years, due to Napoleon's whims and the outcome of the revolution. And he eventually dies in 1805. He's diagnosed with cancer in 1805, and he dies February of 1806 is when he actually passes away. No pensions paid to his family. Paris does erect a statue of him in 1912.
In 1912,
it takes them, you know, about another 100 years or so to actually get to get a statue of him. But it's torn down in 1941 and 42.
You can probably guess by whom.
You can probably guess by who. Yeah. The Nazis tear it down, burn it down, smelt it. So as of this writing, there really isn't a statue to Dumas. There's where the old statue was at in Paris, there is a monument to all of the enslaved folks that had perished and that helped build French society at the time. And Dumas' name is listed, but there's not an actual monument or anything to him, you know, himself for all of he accomplished.
What was his son, Alexandre Dumas, was he recognized? I mean, did those racial laws ever affect him, or did he either pass as white, or was he grandfathered in somehow?
Yeah, he would have been six at the time that his dad passed, and so it would have been a gradual rollback of those race laws, of course. And right. You know,
Napoleon didn't last forever.
Napoleon didn't last forever either. So I think he definitely did. Look black. He did not. You know, I don't think he was able to go undercover or anything. So it was definitely people knew him. But I think at the time by the time he got famous enough because of his writings, of course, it was maybe a little better in society at the time. Right. But yeah, at the time when his family when Alexandre Dumas, the writer, when he was six, the family was more or less, you know, destitute. You know, it was just him and his mother and his siblings, and you know, they had no way to support themselves. And it wasn't until Thomas really started writing, the writer became famous, that they were able to rise above it again.
Wow, a legendary family on a couple of different of different eras, and always kind of starting from nothing again.
Yeah. It's a constant reset. And, you know, it's, you know, our time period now, you know, I'm reading a lot about revolutionary France, getting ready for this. So it's kind of hard not to see parallels with some of the things going on today. And I do want to thank Tom Reese's book, The Black Count, is where a lot of this information came from. So I definitely want to give a shout out to that.
Well, Richard, this has been a fascinating entry in the omnibus. Thank you so much for coming on the show and, expanding certainly my knowledge about the era and these awesome historical figures.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Big fan of the show, long time, so I was definitely jumped at the chance.
All right, great. Well, yeah, you're in the very earliest cadre of new entries in the omnibus, so we appreciate it a lot.
Thank you, sir.
And that concludes Thomas Alexandre Dumas, entry 386.DA1125, certificate number 40773 in the omnibus. Futurelings, as you know, social media is an unholy trash fire and we disavow it. Yet we contribute to Facebook and Instagram at Omnibus Project. Fans of the show congregate on Reddit, Discord, Facebook, and elsewhere under the group sobriquet Futurelings, and you can find them threaded throughout the internet under that search term. Our address for email, which was a popular form of written electronic communication in your distant past, was and is theomnibusproject@gmail.com.
Physical mail, postcards, packages, and talismans may be sent care of the Omnibus Project to 609 Southwest 150th Street, number 48084, Burien, Washington, 98166-998. Our show is listener supported, so please continue joining our Patreon community at patreon.com/omnibusproject. Membership in that community comes with a treasure trove of perks, including years of photos, show notes, outtakes, studio shots, and mail, as well as monthly addenda episodes featuring emeritus co-host Ken Jennings, and depending on the level of subscription, perks including executive and exclusive merch items and bonuses. All Patreon members get early access to weekly episodes on Tuesdays instead of Thursdays. Well worth the money. That's patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Featuring some our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that a catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.